Hello, everybody, and welcome back to For the World. We had the best time attending the Formula E finale in London and wanted to give you a little recap before we dive into an incredible conversation we had with Jeff Dodds, none other than the CEO of Formula E himself. Shout out first to all the amazing people who helped coordinate this weekend, the incredible Amy and Saskia at McLaren, as well as Liv, Maddie, Charlie, Holly, Charlotte, and many, many more on the Formula E side. So thank you very much. I'm Tiggy.
I'm Fiona, and we did truly feel so welcomed. What an introduction into this series.
So awesome. So let's start with our main takeaways and thoughts from the weekend. So first of all, just incredible, incredible racing. I think that's one of the things that stuck out to me is one of the bigger differences between F1 and Formula E, just to start. The cars race so close to each other, and it's just kind of crazy to see them bumper to bumper almost.
It almost looks like a video game or some sort of fighter pilot simulation, you know, because the cars literally look like these little futuristic Batmobiles.
They do. Yeah, for sure. And also, whoever starts on pole is definitely not guaranteed to win the race, which I think is a little different from F1. And obviously, we're seeing more competition in F1, which is great. But Formula E, I feel like, has always sort of had that level of crazy competition, almost akin to like IndyCar, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. I think on top of that, too, the strategy piece of it is so fascinating, because not only do you have this kind of all runners can win situation, but you also have the energy management piece of the strategy, where you're trying to figure out how to deploy your battery and when, where you need to figure out how to take attack mode, if they're going to implement attack charging, so super fast charging in later seasons, how's that going to factor into things? And then, you know, you're trying to manage all that, and then let's say you're running in the mid pack and the front two take each other out, suddenly you have a chance to win. It's just such an exciting dynamic form of racing that I think F1 fans will really enjoy.
And the team around Formula E is just so cool. Like, everybody, it felt kind of like a family in a way, which was really nice and says something given it was our first time there, but we just felt so welcomed and so spoiled, and everybody really seems to care about the series and the mission and the reason that they're all there. So we definitely felt that even just from being there for a weekend. But before we dive in, we're going to give you a super quick high-level Formula E overview if you're not familiar with the series or weekend structure, because it is a bit different. So this season had 16 rounds in city centers. It started in Mexico City and then ended with the doubleheader here in London. A little overview on the teams and the drivers. So there are 11 teams, 22 drivers. And so we'll just list the teams just because I think it's really interesting. There's only one F1 team crossover, which you guessed it, is McLaren. But we have ABT Cupra, Andretti, DS Penske, Envision Racing, ERT, Jaguar, which we learned
the
proper pronunciation of Jaguar is Jaguar. So we learned that. Mahindra, Maserati, McLaren, like we said, Nissan, and still can't really figure out the Tag Heuer, but that's the
don't
Tag
look
Heuer
at me, Tiggy.
Porsche
don't look at me.
Team. But like we said, McLaren's the only F1 team currently with a Formula E team, which they actually took over from Mercedes at the beginning of last season. So I thought that was kind of an interesting fact.
And just a quick note, sustainability note on their season format and their racing calendar. One of the key purposes of Formula E is to really showcase the cities that these races happen in. So they race on city streets, you get city skylines in the background. But that serves a dual purpose. Yes, you get awesome backgrounds and road surfaces for the racing, but you also are in closer to city centers, which means less commutes for fans, less carbon intensive travel for teams, and that way everybody can really stay engaged and stay immersed in the culture of the city, which is a great sustainability strategy piece in addition to the awesome racing that it delivers.
Yeah, like we got to and from the Excel Center in London by bus and by subway every single time, so that was great. So diving into the format, practice. So each event has two 30-minute practice sessions, one on Friday and one on Saturday before racing. On doubleheader weekends like this one, there's only one practice session ahead of the Sunday race. And the regulations, what's interesting here is that power is such a big part of the regulation. So the regulations state that there's 350 kilowatt power available for practice, which is fascinating. quali is where things start to get really interesting. So this is where it differs a lot from F1 in my mind, and where we, I think, had some of the most fun watching. So it's split into two stages. First is the group stage and then the dual stage. So first with the groups, you have two groups, A and B.
11 drivers each.
Yep. And those race basically to get into the dual stage. So if you're in the top, is it three? Top four, I think. If you're in the top four of your group, then you progress to the dual stage, which is where the drivers compete head to head. So it's almost like a bracket where you're facing off against one driver. If you win that, you advance to the semifinal. If you win that, you advance to the final, and whoever wins the final gets pole. And so it's actually really cool. And watching on TV, you get really interesting graphics, kind of real time of on the laps, who's beating who.
And the graphics are super cool in terms of showing you the differentials physically in terms of time where the drivers are. And on the, you know, qualifying format note, Tiggy and I were almost tempted to like fill out little NCAA brackets because we were not expecting qualifying to go the way it did. I think because, you know, there were some pretty strong title leaders going into the weekend, but it was a total mix up in quali as well with the structure that you sort of get similar to the races, which is a big difference from F1, where sometimes the quali format can be pretty predictable and surprises aren't that often. But it definitely kept you on the edge of your seat all the way through qualifying.
Yes. So for the actual race format, this does feel quite similar to F1, though it's definitely shorter. They're usually about 45 minutes instead of an hour and a half to 2 hours. And it's a set number of laps similar to F1. But what's different is that laps can be added for safety car and yellow, full course yellow interruptions. So the total laps to be added are announced usually 3 laps prior to the end of the E-Prix, sort of like stoppage time in soccer, if you or football, we should say, in London. But that is super interesting. And one other thing to note about racing is there are no pit stops. So unless there's a problem, obviously, like mechanically or something's going on, there are no pit stops. And charging the car is forbidden, both during quali and the race, as well as throughout parc fermé and what they call scrutineering. So teams can charge cars in between sessions and during practice, but not any time else. And I think one of the obvious things that we haven't already stated up front, but hopefully people know, is that Formula E stands for Formula Electric. Like, it is an all-electric series. They have electric motors, they have batteries. So that in and of itself is also very different.
But the cool thing about that too is technically they don't get a full allocation of power at the start of the race because they have a dual axle regen system. So when they lift and coast, or if they hit the brakes, their car can actually generate a lot of that power, up to 40% of the power needed to power them through the race. And while charging the car is forbidden during qualifying in the race, there is some talk about adding in attack charge, which has been something that's been thrown around, which is slightly different than attack mode, which we'll talk about in a minute. And attack charge, theoretically, which we should be seeing sometime next season with Formula E, will be where it's kind of like a pit stop, but the teams get a super fast supercharge in the middle of the race. But we'll see how that plays out. It's definitely something that they're still working on. But attack mode is essentially happens during the race, where a driver gets an easy extra hit of power. They have to drive off the racing line and they can pick up an extra 50 kilowatts.
Yeah, super interesting. And when to use that attack mode, you get a certain number of minutes for it, is super strategic. So you do have to split it up. I think you get 8 minutes. It can be 4 and 4. It can be 6 minutes and 2 minutes. But you do have to split it up. And it's, again, kind of like pit stops, tire strategy in F1, where when and where to use that attack mode is super, super important. So let's talk a little bit about the actual weekend experience and what we got up to. So Saturday, we were with the McLaren team, which was incredible. We were with them in their hospitality. We talked to Ian James. We'll insert a little clip of a couple of questions we got to ask him. Ian James is the team principal of the McLaren Formula E and Extreme E team. So he has oversight over both, which is super interesting.
And he came in from the Mercedes squad, so he had a little bit of Formula E experience, but really interesting to see how he's used that experience to transition into leadership for both teams at McLaren.
So we have a predominantly Formula One audience, but would love your take on why Formula E and what you think F1 can learn from Formula E.
I think first and foremost, they both are incredible motorsports, and I think it'd be crazy to pretend that Formula One is anything other than the pinnacle of motorsport. But Formula E actually offers something very different. It's quite an event character here that we have. Obviously, we're showcasing technology in terms of electric vehicle technology. And the racing is incredibly close as well. So I think, again, both can live quite happily in harmony, which is why I'm very proud that McLaren's involved in with both and alongside all of the other series as well. I was talking actually with the CEO of Formula E yesterday, Jeff Dodds, and he gave an interesting analogy, which I thought was absolutely spot on. He'd been to Silverstone with his wife this year, and he said for him, it was a bit like Glastonbury.
Yeah.
You know, you're there, you had the, it was huge, there were crowds of people, you're outside, you came away feeling invigorated, but quite tired at the end of the day. He likened this more to a Taylor Swift concert, and I think that's quite an interesting sort of take on it. And you know what? I'd be quite happy to go to Glastonbury, quite happy to go to a Taylor Swift concert, so I think there's room in the world for both.
The Formula E Eras Tour.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah, you heard it here first. Yeah. So.
It's coming. So looking ahead to season 11, what are your goals for that, and how are you thinking about the technology difference between this season and next season?
Well, we get the opportunity in season 11 to hit the reset button. So we have a two-year homologation phase within Formula E. So we're at the end of the first one for Gen 3 now. What that means is that together with our manufacturing partner, with Nissan, we can really address some of the maybe the gaps that we've got in the package at the moment, and I have absolute faith that they're doing just that. So my expectation is that the performance takes a significant step forward. And then from a technology perspective on the car itself, we're unlocking the front powertrain from a traction point of view. So at the moment it's only used to regen. We're actually going to a position where we can actually use that in traction. So that's going to increase the performance possibilities massively. We're still waiting to see the sporting regulations. So exactly how that's going to work out, we'll have to wait and see. We've got new bodywork coming into the car and various other bits and pieces. So I'm super excited about it. And as I say, I think it's going to take it all to the next level.
Well, they like to keep you on your toes, so.
Certainly do.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And then we also saw Girls on Track. Hopefully you all saw some of those clips that we posted on Instagram, but it was amazing just to get to meet some of these girls and these students who are interested in everything from aerodynamics to communications and marketing, and just super interesting women and roles that they're trying to get into in motorsport, and just a really cool program. So we'll also splice in some of those clips as well.
My name's Jenny Fletcher. I am the Girls on Track UK Programme Manager. The programme aims to inspire, connect and showcase women across the board of motorsport. We're managed by Motorsport UK, which is the governing body of the sport. And my absolute favourite thing about being the programme manager of Girls on Track is making a difference. 8 years down the line now, and we're seeing women in the paddock that have come through the community, have taken on those opportunities and are now living their dream. And for me, that just melts my heart.
So my name's Danielle Andrews, and I am the social media manager at Motorsport UK, which looks after the Girls on Track UK program and all their socials. My favorite thing about working with Girls on Track is that it's kind of come full circle for me, because more than like less than 3 years ago, I was wanting to get into the sport. I was looking at Girls on Track, like, you know, I came actually here to this event and spoke to the Girls on Track stand, and then now to be running the Girls on Track social media to enable like other people to do what I did is just an incredible feeling, and it's just amazing.
So I'm Abby. I'm interested in team management in motorsport, so anything team coordination wise, and the regulations in motorsport as well.
Hi, I'm Nicole. I'm from North London and I'm most interested in aerodynamics engineering.
Hi, my name is Elisa. I'm from Cambridge and I'm interested in the PR and communication side of motorsport.
So hi, I'm Rihanna. I'm from Leicester and I'm really interested in aerodynamics.
And then we did a grid walk. So this was incredible. Obviously our first Formula E grid walk. So fun. You get to go right up close and personal to the cars, the teams, the drivers, as they're all lined up on the grid. And it's just so fun to see the different routines. Like, we saw a lot of drivers giving fist bumps or hugs to every single person who was out there on the team, which was super cool. And just kind of seeing their rituals before they get in the car was amazing, and it was obviously packed, so
and I think even though it was packed, it was a very sort of, we were trying to figure out ways to describe this. In this episode you'll get a teaser about what Jeff Dodds thinks the weekend vibe is like, but to us we are saying it's kind of like a mix of like a outdoor family festival with a business conference. And there are tons of families on the grid, lots of kids, pretty robust mobility access as well. So lots of wheelchair users were able to access the grid, as well as folks with mobility devices, which was really great to see. And of course, you get to get up right close and personal with the tech. One of my favorite moments on the grid walks was the batteries, obviously, like any other form of power provision, need to be cooled. And usually airflow over the battery system is enough to cool it during the race. But when they're sat on the grid, you need a cooling mechanism. So we saw fans with little buckets of ice sat in front of them, with steam coming off, cooling those batteries, which was just a super cool little thing to see. But the grid was super friendly, very, very busy, but also got to say hi to a lot of really cool people and, you know, be within 10 feet of a Hemsworth brother, and not something you get to do every day.
Yes, Liam Hemsworth was getting mobbed, as you would expect, but cool to see him for sure. On Sunday, we spent the day in what's called the Emotion Club. That is Formula E's sort of top-tier hospitality center, where they had a lot of guests, media, sponsors, partners, celebrities, that sort of thing. But it was really an amazing, amazing space, and it was cool. A lot of the Formula E team that we talked to in there, they were like, yeah, treat this like your living room. You're like, make yourself at home. Like, that is so nice. Like, we felt very spoiled. So that was awesome. A couple of the celeb sightings we had. Well, we actually didn't see Draco Malfoy in person, Tom Felton.
Very, very sad about
this. We were on Draco Malfoy lookout for most of the day and unfortunately did not see him. But we did see Liam Hemsworth. We saw Tommy Fury. I don't watch this show. Is it Love Island?
I have no idea, Tim.
I think it's some. It's. I know we're kind of exposing ourselves right now, so don't judge us. But anyway, Tommy Fury was there as well on Saturday. But that was great. And then sort of to wrap up before we transition into the interview. So for season 10, we went into this weekend with 7 drivers mathematically with the chance to win the championship. It was Pascal Wehrlein who took the championship with Porsche, and then Jaguar won the team's championships. That was great. But what was sad is that the actual winner,
the Sunday race at least, was Oliver Rowland, so native Brit, but it was almost overshadowed a little bit, I think, by all the drama going into the doubleheader, because while 7 drivers went in with a mathematical chance on Saturday of winning this championship, by Sunday it had narrowed it down to 3. So it was really tight, really exciting. But congrats both to Pascal Wehrlein, Oliver Rowland, Nick Cassidy, and Mitch Evans on really fabulous drives from everybody this weekend.
And just a quick note on some of the activations and the other experiences. So they have this fan village, which was so amazing. There were so many different activations, from Girls on Track to other educational things to being able to see the Extreme E and Extreme H cars.
And the E1 Pilot Bird electric motorboats, which I was so impressed by.
So cool. And just, yeah, so many different concerts and panels and speakers, and that's sort of where the conference vibe came in. We were like, okay, in the fan village, it just feels like there's so much programming in a really good way and a lot for fans to get involved with. So,
and a lot for fans to learn about too. You know, there's a lot of stuff with sustainability education and also teaching people about how sim racing works and the whole motorsport infrastructure, as well as educating consumers on how battery electric vehicles and charging work, which was super cool to see.
So season 11 kicks off in December in Brazil, and preseason testing kicks off in November. So there's not actually that much of a break until we get to season 11 of Formula E. But with that, we will transition into the Jeff interview. We're super excited to have you all listen to his amazing wisdom. And he mentions at the end about going to Goodman's as his recommendation, his restaurant recommendation. I am heading there tonight, so I will keep you all posted on what that's like.
Have a fabulous time.
Okay, friends, today we're talking about sleep and specifically getting better sleep. If you can relate to having trouble falling asleep and staying asleep and getting good quality sleep, then listen up. We are so excited to share a new product we've been using from Beam, their Dream Powder. our listeners will get a special discount on this dream powder. It's a science-backed, healthy hot cocoa for sleep with no added sugar. It tastes insane. I did it last night, and I woke up this Monday morning feeling incredibly refreshed. I gave it to my little sister, and she loved it too. They also have amazing flavors, sea salt caramel, brownie batter, vanilla chai, and then, of course, the original flavor, cinnamon cocoa. It's been tested for high-quality efficacy and formulated to ease your body into rest, supporting all four stages of the sleep cycle to help you stay asleep longer and fall asleep faster. Other sleep aids can cause next-day grogginess, but Dream contains a powerful all-natural blend of reishi, magnesium, L-theanine, apigenin, and melatonin to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. If you want to try the best-selling Dream Powder, get up to 40% off for a limited time when you go to shopbeam.com/paddockproject and use code paddockproject at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/paddockproject and use code paddockproject for up to 40% off.
Like most people, we love a great deal, but what we don't love is jumping through a million hoops just to end up saving a few dollars, especially when it comes to wireless plans. There's so many promos and offers out there, but they do really make it hard to get good quality savings. With Mint Mobile, it really is so easy though. For just $15 a month, you can get a wireless plan when you get a 3-month plan. And the website and activation process are so seamless. Honestly, the longest part of this process is going to be the time that you spend on hold trying to break up with your old provider. To get started, go to mintmobile.com/F1RTheGirls. There you can see that right now all 3-month plans are only $15 a month, including the unlimited plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan, and you can bring your old phone number along with all of your existing contacts. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/F1RTheGirls. That's mintmobile.com/F1RTheGirls. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/F1RTheGirls. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply.
We have been very busy lately and have been really trying to do everything we can to feel our best as we wind up the summer and head into a very busy fall. And one thing we've been doing to help us and support us is using our Happy Mammoth products, especially Estro Control. It helps to support our hormones and alleviate any of those pesky PMS symptoms, including bloating. And it also assists in maintaining cognitive health and promoting liver function and digestive health. Happy Mammoth also has the amazing Hormone Harmony supplement dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women, and they make no compromise when it comes to quality. For a limited time, get 15% off your order at happymammoth.com with code F1RTheGirls at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code F1RTheGirls for 15% off today.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning F1 championships is sometimes also what you need to keep your beloved car running day in and day out. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're looking for speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has got you covered. They have over 122 million parts for your car. You'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And they have eBay Guaranteed Fit, which means your part is guaranteed to fit your car every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're about burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. So keep your car alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to For the World. We are here with none other than Jeff Dodd, CEO of Formula E and a titan in the business world with experience across media, OEMs, and government. First of all, Jeff, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. And second of all, would love to start. You seem to have the perfect background to run and grow a series like Formula E, which is a bit of a melange of all the things I just mentioned. What made you decide to take your expertise to Formula E, and why now?
Hello, both. I'm still mildly distracted by being called a titan. to be called a titan from somebody called Antigone, it feels very classics, doesn't it? We've gone straight in on the classics on this podcast. So maybe it's one of those things, the CV looks great when you look back at it. In the moment, kind of was never quite the plan. So first half of my career was spent in automotive. So I worked for a company called Premier Automotive Group. They used to be Ford Motor Company, Volvo, Aston Martin, Jaguar, Mercury, this kind of big amalgam of car brands. I worked for Volvo with them, and then I moved to Honda, the big Japanese company. And when I was at Honda, we raced everything. So we had Formula One, touring cars, MotoGP, World Superbikes, British Superbikes, Formula Four, power boat racing. If it had an engine, they raced it, including lawnmowers, I might add. But if it had an engine, they raced it. So I love motorsport. So I kind of grew up around motorsport. I've always watched it. I have a great passion for it. Love Formula One, love MotoGP. And then I drifted off from there and kind of spent the next half of my career in media and telco. I worked for a company called Virgin Media. So originally a kind of Richard Branson concept, was sold to a big American business called Liberty Global. And I worked with them for a number of years. And a few years ago, we merged the business called Virgin Media with O2, so a big UK mobile operator. And after settling in that that business, I really got to a point where I thought, do you know, 12, 13 years of doing media telco and running bits of this business, that's probably long enough. I really fancy just kind of taking a break and resting and recharging and then deciding what else I wanted to do. I'm also the chair of a very big global charity called the Valuable 500. And I was an advisor, a non-exec for the UK government. So I had plenty going on. I didn't, you know, it wasn't I desperately needed to rush into something else. And I spoke to the owner or the CEO of Liberty Global, a chap called Mike Fries, and said, look, here, I'm thinking about this. What do you think? And he said, what I think is you should wait for a bit because I might have something really interesting that you will love. It didn't take him at his most persuasive to get me to take it. Like 14, 15 months. They're like, motorsport is like dog years, isn't it? It's like 7 or 8 times. So I really feel like I've been here 10 years. I think I had like really long flowing hair and a dark, lustrous dark beard when I started it, but so here I am. But you're right in the respect that when I look back, I mean, a lot of this job is about media deals, a lot of it's about broadcast, a lot of it's about marketing and PR and influencers and talent management, and a bit of it is about cars and racing them. And I guess I have little bits of all of that in my career.
Well said. Indeed. So what has been your favorite highlight or moment of season 10 so far?
That's a great question. Let me start on the track and then maybe I'll broaden it out a little bit. I think on the track, there's been a few moments. So in São Paulo, we raced. We had Felipe Massa there, Emerson Fittipaldi, Emerson doing the flag in São Paulo. And of course, McLaren, Sam Bird. Sam Bird won for the first time ever for McLaren in Formula E. And Emerson was there. Last time he won on that track was with McLaren. So that was a pretty emotional moment. So seeing Ian James, the team principal of McLaren's electric teams, and Emerson Fittipaldi, Emerson in tears, hugging it out in the McLaren garage was a lovely, lovely moment. Tokyo was pretty special. So inaugural race in Tokyo, first time they've ever shut the streets of Tokyo for a motorsport event. In fact, first time they've ever shut it for anything other than the Tokyo Marathon, I think. So to be standing there on the grid, absolute full capacity. We sold the tickets out in literally minutes after we went on sale. I had the Prime Minister of Japan on one side, the Governor of Tokyo on the other side on the grid, screaming fans, everyone waving a Nissan flag. And kind of agreeing the race in Tokyo was one of the first things I did as I arrived. So to kind of have that, yeah, let's go for it. Let's secure this race in Tokyo. Then have that moment of standing on the grid in Tokyo and for it to be absolutely full. That was pretty special. And then I think maybe off the track, to be a little selfish, in Portland, which is the last race we had, on the Friday, before the race, first of the two races, Robert Wickens, I don't know if you read that, but Robert Wickens came to test the car. And for anybody listening in who doesn't know Robert's story, so Robert was perhaps one of the most talented junior racers of all time, coming through, test driving for Formula One, was seen as one of the top rising stars in IndyCar, was actually doing remarkably well in IndyCar, had a very large accident in one of the IndyCar races, crashed out, actually was quadriplegic as a result of the accident. Regained over time, I think a lot of therapy and a lot of determination on his side, regained use of his arms, never regained use of his legs. But I saw Robert again, very soon after I started, I had breakfast with Robert in Indianapolis. I was out there seeing Michael Andretti, and Robert and I arranged to meet. And I had breakfast with this most amazingly determined individual who was just desperate to prove that he could still compete at the highest level. He got back into racing in the pilot series with Hyundai, actually went on to win that, but it's a two-person series in effectively a touring car. And he really wanted to get back into open-seater or open-wheel single-seater racing. Mm-hmm. So it then went quiet, but Robert thought it had gone quiet fully. But in the background with the FIA, we were adapting and working on the car. So Spark, who make the car and adapt the car and set it up for us, were making an adapted version of the Formula E car that Robert could drive. So when we contacted him and said, look, we've adapted the car, come to Portland and let's see how it feels. He was kind of speechless because he just assumed it was another one of those conversations you have that never go anywhere. And he came to the track. It's the first time he'd been in a single-seater car since the accident.
Wow.
He got into that adapted car, and we just said, look, just have fun and just see how it feels. As it happens, how they'd adapted the steering wheel was a bit awkward for him, because as he turned the sharp corners at Portland, he had to release the buttons that were the throttle and then had to go back on. So he wasn't able to keep the power down through all of the corners, the tight corners. But he basically put down a time in his second or third lap that was 3 or 4 seconds outside of the qualifying times that the drivers were doing the day after. So it's an amazing moment for me because in some respects we got to show Robert that he can still compete at that level, which for me in some respects feels like a win in itself. But what came off of it was a lot of the teams talking to him to say, look, we have a rookie test coming up at the start of next year. Are you open to coming to put in a proper test to see if we can get you into a seat? So that's a long answer, I guess. I've given you three. I cheated,
Jen.
I gave you three. but it's a long season that goes in the blink of an eye. And if I sat here for another hour, I'm sure I come up with 20 other things. That whether it's Sun Kang with the Liberty Walk guys for the adapted, you know, making their adapted car in Tokyo was also amazing. First time back in China since COVID in Shanghai was amazing. But I suspect, if you ask me that question in a week's time, given what's about to unfold in London and how delicately balanced that whole thing is, maybe the answer will relate to this weekend, not what's gone before.
Well, we certainly hope so, because I will be there, which I'm very, very excited for.
Very cool. Why aren't you both going
to
be there?
I know. I'm trying to get Chessa to come.
Chessa, what's the deal?
Oh, I just started a new job, so I have a lot of work. And Tiggy's actually going to the Olympics too.
Is it a new job that requires you to work on Saturday and Sunday?
Oh, yeah, you got me there.
Great question.
Yeah, I can feel no. We have offices at all the races because obviously the teams have to work away there. So you can like duck in and out. You can sit there doing all your preppy stuff in the office, like work related. Come out,
I'll
watch
use
the race,
your office.
Get back. Yeah, I'm super cool with that.
I'll keep working on her. Don't worry. No, but that's an incredible answer because it shows how passionate you are about this series and how many exciting moments there are. And we want to dig in a little bit to the mission side of Formula E. Obviously, the way it was started, there's a big focus on sustainability. And I'm curious if that, the mission side of things and the focus on sustainability and on electric and on changing transportation was part of the reason you joined, and kind of what you think about what role can and should sports play in the broader conversation of tackling climate change.
So I think, by the way, I realize this could sound like a very privileged answer because not everybody has the ability to only choose roles that kind of align very closely with their value set. Not everyone's lucky to be in that position. I found myself at almost every stage of my career to land in an organization where what they cared about, I cared about. So whether it was Honda or not, I'll tell you a little interesting, funny story about Honda. It was funny, but it's interesting. So I haven't been at Honda for 15, 16, 17 years, a long time, maybe even longer than that. But Honda, whenever they get new interns coming into the business, once they get a certain critical mass, like 20 or 30 of them, they do an induction session where one of the executive team will come to the session and they tell them about the history of Soshiro Honda, the founder, what he cared about. It was all about racing. It was all about the environment. And they do this full-on kind of induction session. Now, I haven't been there for, as I say, nearly 20 years. If someone phoned me today and said, oh my God, we've got an induction session going on just around the corner from your house and the exec that was going could make it, any chance, I could walk in there today and still present that induction.
Wow.
And the same would be the case for Virgin Media and then for Liberty Global. And I think if you're lucky enough to find yourself in organizations where you can really connect with what they care about, it makes such a massive difference. And I definitely wouldn't have gone anywhere from Liberty Global. But when I looked at this business, now I knew a bit about it already. So I'd been as a fan to watch races in New York with my son. And I knew what was going on here. But the things I care about in terms of sustainability, social and environmental, I'd done a lot of work on social sustainability and inclusion and belonging and trying to create opportunities for everyone who has potential, but perhaps not the opportunity to realize that potential. All those things really matter to me. Fascinated with automotive, love cars, really interested in technology and innovation, came out of a kind of a broadband telco business. Of course I did. So when I put all those things together and I turned up here to be part of something which is, if you think about the EV revolution, to be part of an organization that is really trailblazing in that space. So the manufacturers in Formula E are learning things about EV development on the racetrack, like a laboratory, and it's going back to their production and their R&D departments who are using that in the cars they're building for the future, for tomorrow. So that for me is amazing.
Yeah.
At the same time, wherever we race, we try and leave a positive social legacy, so a positive social impact. We're also the only sport in the world that signed up to science-based targets. We're the number one sport in the world for ESG and sustainability. So to be able to kind of get all the things that are important to me out of a job that's just super exciting and really good fun and has such a lot of growth potential is a bit of a blessing, really.
It's amazing. Absolutely. And you mentioned the laboratory, the laboratory.
Yeah.
And we've always talked about how motorsport can be sort of like an R&D lab for the real world. What technologies in FE do you think have the biggest impact to change the broader automotive industry?
Yeah. So first of all, I should say, and I have to declare this because people think I'm super anti Formula One, by the way, but I'm actually like you are a massive Formula One fan. So we could nerd off about Formula One for hours, but I love Formula One. But Formula One drives on a technology that's effectively 130 years old. So, you know, the internal combustion engine, the Otto engine, 1896 or something, it was created. And they've effectively optimized and iterated that technology to within an inch of its life. So they have absolutely maximized the potential out of that technology. And in order to get more out of it, of course, the investments are very high. Fortunately, the cost caps are very high as well, so they can make those investments. We are in the infancy of this technology. So the first time we saw a road car launched with EV capability en masse, I guess, I think it was 2008, and that was the Tesla Roadster. Then the Nissan Leaf and various other cars came through, but we're in the infancy of the technology. So genuinely, there are learnings around the powertrain and battery technology and how those two things communicate with each other. We're also a massive software-driven series. So there is constant, if you went and sat in a garage, when a car comes in to Formula One or NASCAR, IndyCar, you pop the hood or you're removing the chassis and there are spanners in the garage. Rarely happens in Formula E. What you see is someone plugging in a laptop really quickly and starting to code and work on code. It's a very, very different type of tech. So where we are right now in the tech means powertrain development is on an incredible curve. So the fact that we go from 0 to 60 of 2.7 seconds now, and in December the new car gets there in 1.8 seconds, a 35% reduction, is because we have two powertrains, a front and rear, we're activating both, so it becomes all-wheel drive on powertrain tech. And the batteries, you've only got to go back to the start of Formula E, the batteries couldn't last a race. So you had these crazy kind of triathlon transitions where a driver would jump out of one car, get into another car to do the second half of the race. Now the batteries last for the whole race and we're leading battery technology. And I imagine within 5 to 6 years, we'll be on solid state battery where it comes down and it's a quarter of the size, but more powerful than the batteries that exist today. So we're kind of at the cutting edge of all this tech. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to the manufacturers, they always kind of drop a story in. that I don't know about. And I'm like, what? That's crazy. So if you talk to Jaguar, this wonderful story where they say, oh yeah, well, we learned some really cool stuff about how the software, how we can drive more efficiency out of the battery through the software and how we code it and the powertrain interaction. And what we learned on the racetrack, we realized would work just as well on the road. So for the I-Pace range of cars, the Jaguar I-Pace, they were able to do an over-the-air update to the software in the I-Pace. And people went to bed and woke up the following day and they had 35 more kilometers of range on their battery.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so stuff like that. I hear these stories and I'm like, that's why what we do is really important, because we know the transition from hybrid or petrol or diesel cars to electric vehicles comes with some nervousness for people around range anxiety and performance of the car and charging ability and stuff like that. Anytime we can show that things are moving in a positive direction, it's amazing for me because it speeds up the migration.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where it's not only affecting the drivers on track, that has the impact or the potential to impact millions, billions across the world, which is
100%. Yeah. Incredible. And if you go to places like China, so we race in Shanghai, of course, roughly one in every two new cars sold in China are electric vehicles already. The infrastructure is unbelievable when you're in Shanghai. And over there, some of the conversations we'd have in Europe, for example, are just not being had because everyone's already bought into the concept. They bought into the tech. The Chinese EV manufacturers are leading the world in terms of development, certainly on scale. And that's the journey we're going on for the rest of the world. And that's why it's really important for us that we keep a global footprint.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about how the technology of Formula E is at the infancy. But I think people also forget the Formula E is a relatively new series. It's only about a decade old and it's the fastest growing motorsport series. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I think that's correct. True.
Yeah.
And so why do you think the series is best positioned to become the largest in motorsport? And do you view other series as competitors, as allies, both?
Yeah. So I'll be a bit nerdy for a second because I'll just throw some numbers at you. So you're right, we're in our 10th year. This is our 10th season. But you've got to really factor in two massively disruptive years because of COVID in the middle.
Yeah.
And for a startup business, if you imagine a startup business that's event driven, which we are, getting to a point where it's just started to really get to maximum speed of growth and then be literally stopped in its tracks, no pun intended, stopped in its tracks by COVID for effectively two seasons, it was massively disrupted. So you could argue we're 10 years old. You could also argue that we're just two or three years into rebuilding the business. 10 years ago, there were zero Formula E fans in the world. We didn't exist. Today, there are around 400 million Formula E fans in the world. I'll put that in context for you. And we use the same survey methodology that other motorsports use. So Formula One will have probably between 800, 850 million fans around the world. MotoGP, about 500, 510 million fans around the world. And then we're there at 400. Both MotoGP and Formula One are about 75 years old. So if you think about how far we've come in such an incredibly short period of time. But I also think, to your question about allies, competitors, I always say, you know, Formula One doesn't have to fail for us to be successful, or vice versa. You know, there are roughly, I think it's a $60 billion industry, motorsport, and there are 2 billion motorsport fans around the world. That is more than enough of an industry to sustain two world championship single-seater series with very different fan bases, because Formula One is predominantly, you guys will break the mold,
we're trying.
Predominantly male, predominantly a bit older. And often grow up with a legacy of Formula One in the family, which is they've grown up watching it with a grandfather or a grandparent or a grandmother or a mum or dad on the sofa. So Formula E fans, 50-50 split male-female. Half our audience under the age of 40. And a lot of them, not all of them, a lot of them new to motorsport. Yeah. And if you think about it, it's quite a different proposition. So I was at Silverstone last weekend. Weekend before, watching the British Grand Prix. And when I look around, we're very different propositions. So Silverstone for me feels like Formula One does really, a festival. It's a festival experience. Yeah. Whereas so for me, going to Silverstone to watch the Grand Prix is a bit like going to Glastonbury You know, I'm driving there, it's heavy traffic, I'm parking in the field, I'm cutting in through the hedge or the fence and with the burger vans and everything. And it's a real festival feeling, which I love, by the way. It's a real festival feeling. Coming to Formula E and you'll come to London feels more like going to a Taylor Swift concert, which is it's much more condensed, high entertainment. The racing itself is 40 minutes, 45 minutes. It's not an hour and a half. It's just a different feeling. It's more family oriented. It's shorter. Arguably, the event experience is more polished. It's just very different. I love going to a festival and I love going to a concert. And therefore, I don't see why we have to force people to choose which one of those things they prefer. They can love them both. And then when you factor in the growth of EV technology, for me, that is a tailwind, mm-hmm. which we continue to ride. By 2035, most countries in the world have committed to not allow new car sales to be anything other than alternative fuel, including electric. So you wouldn't be able to buy a petrol or diesel car. I think Norway goes first in 2025. You have a whole tranche go in 2030, and then the remainder largely go in 2035, which for me means in 10 years' time, we will be the preeminent technology. You won't be able to buy a car that's not alternative fuel. And therefore, over the next 10 years, I expect us to continue to grow as we ride that wave of technology take up. And then that to be a very interesting moment to see what happens around that time. I have two boys. I've got a 15-year-old and a 13-year-old. The likelihood is they will never drive a car that isn't electric technology, and maybe beyond that, a different technology in the future. So that's why it's really important to me we keep connecting with this younger audience and bringing them through, because they are natives of the EV revolution. You know, they're not transitory like I was. You know, I started life in a pure petrol car on leaded fuel. Then I went to unleaded fuel. Then I went to a hybrid car. Then I went to an electric car. I've been on that entire journey. They will start their journey with EV tech.
That's so exciting, and definitely for the future. It's definitely where we're going. And I think it's great that Formula E is riding that wave. And you did mention Formula One and other FIA championship series.
Yeah.
How much are you actually collaborating, talking to, for example, Stefano, about the growth and strategy of FE on the sustainability side? Is there conversations happening there?
There isn't really. So I would say we don't collaborate particularly.
Right.
But actually, we race in a couple of the same places, though. So we obviously race in Mexico City on the same circuit. We race in Shanghai on the same circuit. But that's not intentional. So we don't work mm-hmm. in collaboration. Formula One is actually owned by a company called Liberty Media. Formula E is owned by a company called Liberty Global. Mm-hmm. Unsurprisingly, because there's a similarity in the name, the chair of both of those organizations is a gentleman called John Malone. So a very famous US businessman. So if you track up high enough up the tree, you actually get to the same chairperson, you get to John Malone. But they're very separate businesses, independently listed on the NASDAQ, run separately. So I wouldn't say there's no opportunity to collaborate in the future, but it's not something that happens today. And I think largely because our similarity is we're world championships. We race under the FIA regulations. Mm-hmm. We're both single-seater and we're open wheel. Outside of that, you've got DNA in street racing, city racing. Their yeah. DNA in big circuit racing, largely out of town. You've got petrol, now hybrid, combustion. You've got fully electric vehicle. You've got real focus on sustainability. You've got an emerging interest in becoming more sustainable, which are quite different things. Whilst there are similarities and they're racing cars, if you scratch beneath the surface of that, we're fundamentally very, very different series.
Yeah. Another difference is one could argue the level of competition on the track.
Yeah.
So heading
yeah.
into London,
yeah.
we have seven drivers in contention for the championship,
yeah.
which is incredible.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the level of competitiveness in both series has led to yeah. a highly publicized bet from you.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You'll give $250,000 to the charity of choice of the driver
yeah.
who beats Max Verstappen in the F1 championship.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you still feeling 99% confident that Max Verstappen will be the 2024 F1 championship? Is that
yeah.
bet still on?
So look, I often get taken out of context. I didn't on that particular occasion, but I think I was rather publicly put on the back page of a lot of UK newspapers for saying I said F1's boring. Now, just so we're clear, a lot of people in F1 were saying F1 is boring at that particular time.
Absolutely.
So totally I don't think there was anything massively controversial about that. I think what I said about F1 at the time was, look, F1 goes in cycles. And you see dominance, you either see manufacturer dominance, and you'd rarely see a driver dominance without the car being dominant as well. The two, when the two collide and you get a great driver in a dominant car, you can see these long periods of dominance. And we saw it with Lewis, we saw it with Michael Schumacher, and we're seeing it with Max. And my point on that was simply, when you've wrapped up the series win roughly halfway through the season, that's not massively exciting for Formula One fans, because then you're showing an interest in what comes second or who comes third or the battles behind the lead. Now, I feel marginally more optimistic this season because I think, not that we want to spend this whole pod talking about Formula One, but I feel like other cars have got slightly better and the Red Bull car hasn't developed particularly beyond where it was. And therefore, the gap has closed. And for me, whether it's Lando or Charles or Carlos or whoever, George or Lewis from the weekend, seeing more people in contention makes it more interesting. But and I think we're 12 races into Formula One season. By the way, I'm no expert on this. So I don't have the data in front of me. But I think we're 12 races in, and I think Max has won 7 of those, and the other 5 have been won by one person each. Yeah. Charles, Carlos, Lewis, George, and have I missed one?
Lando.
So, and he's whatever, he's 75 points ahead or whatever he's ahead. Mm-hmm. So I'm feeling pretty good that the bet is safe on one hand. On the other hand, I don't feel bad that it's becoming much more competitive because a very healthy and exciting Formula One is great for all motorsport because it just creates a halo over motorsport, which attracts more people in to watch it. So I feel like I'm good on both counts. I'm good that the bet's probably safe, and I feel better that it's becoming a more competitive proposition. But you are so right, Tiggy. In the 9 seasons that have gone before of Formula E, there's only been one 2-time winner. That was Jean-Éric Vergne. Every other season been won by, whether it's Nyck de Vries or Stoffel Vandoorne or Jake Dennis last year. Yeah. Every season that I can think of has come down to the last race undecided. And this one's particularly sticky because we come to the last race with 7 mathematically that could win it. I'm not doing Antonio Felix da Costa, and I'm trying not to do Ollie Rowland a disservice here, but probably more realistically 3. Although I think given Dax on a run 3 in a row and 4 out of 5, I wouldn't write off if he wins the first one. He'll have his sights on the second one. But I think really Nick Cassidy, Mitch Evans and Pascal Wehrlein are up for a blockbuster weekend. And if Nick doesn't win the first race and one of those other two guys does, I think the shackles are all off for Sunday. I think it's going to be. And that is a complicated racing circuit, as in it's tight. It's technical, has a very technical section where you go from the inside section to the outside section. If we get a bit of UK drizzle, as we had last year, where you go from perfectly dry, beautiful indoor surface to the outdoor section, that is squirrely. And therefore, it could be an interesting weekend. Put it this way, no one's etching the trophy yet.
Yes.
Well said.
So exciting.
It's going to be absolutely thrilling. So last question here before we jump into some of our fun rapid fire questions that we usually wrap with. So we're American. We know that the US is 1, a huge market for EV sales, 2, has a lot of manufacturers, and 3, has this massive, what we think is an untapped motorsport fandom.
Yeah.
And next year we have Miami and Portland for the FE series. So talk to us about how you're envisioning the US market and the growth that you could see as you expand here.
So the way I describe it, I like all motorsports. So obviously follow IndyCar, follow NASCAR as well. So the way I describe the continuum of motorsport is on one end, you've got Formula One. In terms of competitive nature of the race, is a very, very, very predictable at the moment. It might change. The other end, you and actually, I would say qualification is incredibly important. You want to start at the front of the grid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the other end, you get NASCAR, which is just like a donkey derby of motor racing, which is rubbings racing. Everyone's jutted up to each other. They're kind of rustling the whole way around. And you largely get us in IndyCar sitting in the middle somewhere, which is, you know, more competitive than Formula One, but not a combat sport, right? So you get kind of, we sit in the middle. When we've raced in the US and we've raced in Portland, we raced there for the first time last year. And I was there. I was kind of talking to fans coming in. I was talking to fans going out, and it was predominantly an IndyCar fan base because it's the PIR that used to IndyCar racing there. And coming in, there was a lot of them, which was good, very intrigued. But coming in kind of a bit, don't know what this is, electric vehicles, you know, a bit strange. Then there was a moment of, oh my God, we've never seen infrastructure like this at an IndyCar race, because there's big premium hospitality, massive fan village, loads of entertainment, kind of things that they haven't experienced at an IndyCar race. So a bit blown away by that. And then leaving, it was all about, that's some of the most competitive racing we've ever seen.
Yeah. That's amazing.
So to race Saturday, Sunday there this year, and for Sunday's crowd to actually be bigger than Saturday's, which is unheard of on a race weekend, and for everyone to see great racing again, gives me massive confidence that the US market likes that style of racing. Yeah. We've also got Roku and CBS as big broadcast partners in the US, so that's very helpful. And we're beginning to find much more interest from US media, US celebrities contacting us, because we fit with a lot of the sustainability angle, which is, yeah, a lot of celebs, a lot of broadcasters are really interested in motorsport, but also really interested in progression and sustainability. So we tick those boxes. So I've always said, Cesar, that we really want to be having multiple races in the US. Now, remind me next year, but, you know, whether it's Los Angeles, New York, Atlanta, Detroit, Phoenix, all places we're talking to, you know, I think we can sustain two very big races in the US, and then we see whether the appetite goes beyond that. But also, we've got two big US teams. We have Andretti, Michael Andretti, and we have Penske, Jay Penske. They're doing pretty well. What we don't have, as you know, is an American-born OEM. So we don't have General Motors or Ford today. And I'm super keen. I would love to have one of those two organizations, you know, dive in, because I think they would bring an enormous amount of interest, US interest, to the series. And I think, you know, the combination, not suggesting this would be the combination, but, you know, a combination of an Andretti or Penske with a big US car manufacturer coming in as well, I think it would be amazing for the sport.
Yeah, we would certainly love that.
Yeah.
So to wrap up, these will hopefully be pretty easy for you. Some quick rapid fire questions. First up, if you had to choose a favorite Formula E technology, what would it be?
Actually, I'm going to go with the software, because I think the future is software driven, data driven, AI driven, and we absolutely lead the charge in that space.
Amazing. Favorite FE race?
Racetrack or race? Do you mean what's my favorite FE racetrack? Circuit?
Yes, let's do that.
I'm going to go with San Paolo.
Okay, good answer. Favorite sport outside motorsport to watch or to participate in?
Well, I'm sitting in like a cave of sporting memorabilia. So the two sports I would say I spend most time engaging and reading with it. Do you know, I'm a massive sport fan. I watch every sport. From my wife famously tells the story of her being woken up in the middle of the night during the Olympics with me getting excited, bouncing up and down on the bed. And it was the dressage. Yeah. So like, I'm like not a good person to ask, because I get excited about everything. I would say golf I play the most. I use it for mindfulness than anything else. I love being out in nature. My son's playing. Boxing, I absolutely love, passionate about it. But rugby, cricket, I literally watch everything.
I love and dressage. Good to know.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't love a bit of dressage? Or as I call it, horse dancing.
I would love to go to dressage at the Olympics in a couple weeks at Versailles.
There we go. Well, that would be an amazing place to see it as well.
And last question, your favorite or best hometown recommendation, restaurant, museum, anything that you
London.
To yeah.
Is it for you or for anybody coming?
Anybody.
Because they're different
anyone
things.
Anyone listening.
Yeah.
So, I'm biased because I've been in the city for most of my life, I love lots of cities around the world, but it's home for me, and therefore, you know, I would implore everyone to come and see it. I'm going to go on restaurant then, and I'm going to say, if you love a good steak, somewhere like Goodman's Steakhouse is just absolutely fantastic, right in the heart of the city. If it's to watch entertainment, I have to say this weekend it has to be Us, doesn't it? But you've also got Lord's Cricket Ground, you've got the Oval, you've got Wembley, you've got Twickenham for rugby. If you're coming for a sporting event, some of the best sporting stadiums in the world. But if I have a hankering for kind of home cooked food, then then it's Goodman's Steakhouse.
Okay, I'll add that to my list for next week.
Very good. So where are you both based, by the way? Where are you dialing in from?
Both in New York City.
So you're both sitting in New York City now?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So we wouldn't say no to Effie coming back to New York.
Yes.
Okay, well, we need to find the right venue if we're going to come back to New York, don't we? Maybe you can direct us. Send us a Google Maps image.
Absolutely. Well, Jeff, thank you so much. This has been an incredible conversation. We really enjoyed it, and wishing you the best of luck for this weekend. And we can't wait to be there in person.
Thank you very much. I'll see you there.